This episode of Racist Sandwich is supported by Abbey Creek Vineyard, a winery committed to supporting minority winemakers in Oregon and embracing all customers from veterans to beginners. Abbey Creek invites you to come sip on a glass of wine at The Crick in North Plains, Oregon. Find them at abbeycreekvineyard.com. That's A-B-B-E-Y, creekvineyard.com. You're listening to Racist Sandwich, the podcast on food, race, class, and gender. This is Solejo. So I went to San Gabriel Valley in Los Angeles for the first time last week. And this is relevant to the interview, I promise. And it was the first time in a long time that I felt so normal. You know, because San Gabriel Valley has a lot... It has a lot of Asian people. I don't know how else to say it. And it's amazing because it's Asian American people. And those are folks that I've never really spent a ton of time with, relatively speaking. I went to the Asian AF comedy show at the Upright Citizens Brigade, thanks to my friend Jenny Yang. I went on a giant food tour with my friend Quincy, who's a producer of Asian Americana and Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, two really great podcasts. And he took me to Koreatown, took me to Dim Sum, just everywhere. And I was amazed at how entrenched Asian America was in this area. I never really grappled with it before, except as this sort of abstract identity that, you know, I happened to fall under. But I never really interacted with it as a culture. And going there made me realize just how different my upbringing was. My family's Vietnamese, and after they escaped from Vietnam in 75, they were able to get sponsored by someone who lived in Freeport, Illinois, which isn't, you know, a big town. It's in the middle of America, and maybe two other Vietnamese families got sent to that area. And I recently had my aunt interview my grandfather and grandmother for me about their experience. And they said that they had too many kids, so that the waiting lists for Houston and LA for people like them were too long. And so they just opted for Freeport. And I just couldn't help but wonder, how different would life be if we actually were able to go to these hubs of Vietnamese culture? And there's actually this story. I don't know. I think of all these what ifs, right? There's a story that I've probably told on the podcast before, but I'm going to tell it again. That's pretty apocryphal on my family. I don't know if it's real, but I like it because it perfectly encapsulates like who we are, and also just the weird hand of fate that put us where we ended up. And it was so my grandfather got to choose between Taiwan and the United States when they were on the boat that rescued them when they were floating off the coast of Vietnam. And he got asked, Taiwan or the U.S.? And so he put the question to the family, my aunts and uncles and my grandmother, and he asked them all, would you rather eat hamburgers or dumplings? And the story goes, obviously, as I'm speaking to you in perfect American English, they chose hamburgers. And yeah, I don't know, something about that and something about how so much of my identity is rolled up in these really big choices that I had no control over is really interesting to me. And so going to the San Gabriel Valley, going to LA, and just interacting with all these Asian Americans who grew up around other Asian Americans who weren't related to them was amazing. And because so much of what I know about Vietnamese culture is through my family, their friends, and Paris by Night, which is, if you haven't seen it, it's this totally ridiculous variety show that Vietnamese Americans love that's based out of California, entirely produced by the Vietnamese American community. And it's this really, it's interesting. There's a lot of music and dance, and it's also very culturally conservative, especially with regard to gender. But my grandparents and my family watched it all the time. And my friend Quincy pointed out, too, how funny it is that it's Paris by night, and not even, like, California by night, but Paris to Vietnamese people represents so much, like, cosmopolitanism and, like, being really cultured and sophisticated, despite the fact that there was this huge war for independence from France that sparked the American War as well. That's pretty interesting. And so when I first heard that Viet Thanh Nguyen won a Pulitzer for his novel, I'd actually never heard of him, but I was like, wait, a Vietnamese person? And he wrote about the Vietnam War. This is so, like, I couldn't even imagine that being recognized by an institution like the Pulitzer Committee. And so I read The Sympathizer as soon as I heard, and I bought it. And his depiction is mostly of the Vietnamese-American community in SoCal, and it was the first depiction that I've ever really grappled with in literature, and it seemed like a fantasy world. I was like, wow, all these Vietnamese people hanging out together, going to events, still talking about Vietnam, and wearing these military uniforms and parading and being really political still. Whereas my family is just, I love them, and they're very much just assimilated because they had to be, and they didn't really have that political kind of base. Like, Vietnamese politics is so apart from my experience, but that's what I found so fascinating in Viet Thanh Nguyen's work. So yeah, it almost felt like a fairy tale of what life would have been like if we had made slightly different choices, and I love that. So yeah, enjoy this great interview between Zahir and Viet Thanh Nguyen, the acclaimed author of both fiction and nonfiction. Right now I'm reading through The Refugees, but I can't finish it because my mom stole it for a trip. So that's also a really fantastic book. So enjoy. This episode of Racist Sandwich is supported by People's Food Co-op and their 4,000 plus community members, offering responsibly sourced produce, groceries, and bulk items at fair prices since 1970. People's works with over 40 local farms and runs Portland's oldest farmers market every Wednesday from 2 to 7 p.m. Visit them at Southeast 21st Avenue, just south of Division Street in Portland, Oregon. Or visit peoples.coop. That's peoples.coop.
Viet Thanh Nguyen is the author of The Sympathizer, which won the 2016 Pulitzer Prize. His nonfiction book, Nothing Ever Dies, was nominated for the National Book Award. And his most recent book is the short story collection, The Refugees, which is getting rave reviews. This past week, he was shortlisted for the International Dublin Literary Award. And at the moment, he's in Portland, receiving the Creative Writing Book Award from the Association for American Studies. Welcome to Racist Sandwich.
Thank you so much for having me, Zahir.
So Racist Sandwich basically is a podcast about food, race, gender, and class. So Saleh is a chef, and I'm a journalist and writer. And sort of the idea of the show came about when Soleil, who's, as I said, Vietnamese-American, was a head chef at a restaurant, and her menu was criticized for being too Asian. She had, like, 3 dishes out of 35. And I thought, like, that's something that I sort of relate to a lot as a writer, where, you know, I write a few stories about being Muslim, and people say, is that all you do? And so I thought, like, what is as a writer, I'm always thinking about audience. You know, who do I write for? And chefs have to think about as well, like, if an Indian cook cooks for a predominantly Indian audience. And so the podcast really is about food and race, and we sort of explore these themes. And I know you wrote a terrific piece in the LA Times about cultural appropriation, but I wanted to start, if you don't mind, with your childhood. So I know you grew up partly in San Jose, and your parents owned a grocery store. Can you explain about what the experience was like growing up?
So my parents opened perhaps the second Vietnamese grocery store in San Jose, California, and the store itself was pretty much what you would imagine a so-called ethnic grocery store would look like. I mean, its function was to sell goods that Vietnamese people would identify with home, with their home cuisine. Everything from candy to various kinds of meats, cuts of meats in particular, to various kinds of goods that they would need to make their food, like fish sauce, obviously, but
yeah,
other kinds of spices as well, and rice. And they lived the typical refugee or immigrant shopkeeper lifestyle, which is they had to work really, really hard every day of the week, 12 to 14 hours a day.
Yeah.
And for the most part, you know, I didn't have to go work there, so I was spared from that kind of an experience. I just had to go occasionally to help them do things like stamp cans with prices.
Yeah.
But my real work for that store was to do the accounting at night after they came home. So after dinner, the work for the store would continue because we'd have to process all of the checks and food stamps and everything for that. But the store itself, I do remember when I would visit how intensely it smelled. It had the odors of these foods.
Yeah.
And these odors were not the odors of Safeway, for example, which was two blocks down the street.
Yeah.
So for me, the idea of so-called ethnic food or ethnic grocery stores was always associated with alienness and foreignness because the it smelled different, it looked different, the goods were different. And I knew that we were in this, you know, very small, enclosed, claustrophobic space, overcrowded with things, unlike the brightly lit Safeway with the wide aisles and shopping carts and all those kinds of things.
Interesting. Did you feel ashamed about your food growing up? Like, you know, I grew up nearby in Sacramento, and I used to beg my mom not to put Indian food in her lunch because it's like, mom, and I sort of like distanced myself. I didn't even want people to come over because I didn't like them making fun of my mom's food. Did you feel that sort of sense of shame around your food?
Partially, although I think it was also just puzzlement, like what is the stuff that we're eating?
Yeah.
So it wasn't as if we were eating like really interesting exotic foods or anything. We were eating sort of like the most fundamental kinds of food items you can imagine. So my parents, because they worked 12 to 14 hours a day, didn't really have a whole lot of time to cook. So they would come home and they would most oftentimes boil things. And they would boil cuts of meat that I thought were really strange.
Yeah.
Like tongue, liver, tripe, things like this. And that was my perception. I wasn't really ashamed of it. I just thought, I thought this is weird. And, you know, you probably would not see this in the homes of other people. But since, you know, it was not really accustomed to invite people over to our house, I thought that's not really such an issue. I did have a good friend who was Mexican-American. I got invited over to his house quite often. And his mom would make, you know, beans and tortillas and stuff like that. And I don't know if he felt ashamed of his food. It didn't seem like it. But I thought this, to me, was actually perfectly normal. And I think that if my mom was a person who would stay at home and make Vietnamese food, I don't think I would have felt embarrassed about it.
Yeah.
So it was a situation in which I just knew that this food was different and strange, but not necessarily shameful.
You know, growing up was, you know, of course, you're a refugee and you speak a lot very powerfully about displacement. Was food a type of home for you? Did you ever sort of see food as like, you know...
Yeah, I mean, food was home, but I think we have to qualify what home means. I think, for me, home does not mean a sentimental thing. It doesn't mean that home is the place you always feel at home. For me, home was a place where I often felt uncomfortable. I mean, I did feel at home. I had my own room, which was a luxury, given my background, and it was a place of solitude because my parents were always off working. But that was also uncomfortable because I actually wanted that house to be full of people. I wanted friends and noise and relatives and all of that. I didn't have that. And then when my parents were home, it was an uncomfortable space because oftentimes there was a lot of tensions because they were tired after working 12 to 14-hour days. And, you know, I had obviously the sense that they sacrificed enormously to make this home possible. And then there would be all kinds of cultural conflicts at home, too. So for me, home was always this very diverse space of everything ranging from comfort to conflict. And so food represents that as well, that food can be a comfort food. I grew up eating pho, for example, and I'm very familiar with that. But then food was also eating this boiled tongue that hadn't been scraped yet and just, you know, dipping it in the blandest possible concoction of fish sauce. And so it's all of those things at once for me.
Interesting. So I know you studied at UC Berkeley. I came in a few years after you, and you studied with Maxine Hong Kingston. I was in her class as well, too, although I was one of those freshmen and, like, you know, didn't get a chance much interaction with her. But so her book is celebrating its 40th anniversary. I know she's had a big impact on you. Can you describe about, you know, the experience of studying with such a seminal author and how she influenced your writing?
Well, at the time, I think I knew that she was a famous author, but I was 19 or 20. So famous author, whatever that means, you know, and I took it for granted that I got into her class. I had a smaller class than you, apparently. I had the Creative Nonfiction Writing Seminar, which is 14 students. And, you know, my experience in that class was that I sat as close to her as I am sitting from you, which is a couple of feet, and I would fall asleep every single day.
Really?
You know, I was such an ingrate.
Yeah.
But you know, what teachers do for you is oftentimes something that you don't recognize immediately. And what I mean by that is that I have been dealing with the lessons of her pedagogy and her writing for decades. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now we have a very cordial relationship. We've done several appearances together and everything. And I've had an opportunity over decades to reflect upon the power of the writing that she's done in things like The Woman Warrior and other books, and about her presence as an anti-war activist, peace activist, teacher, writer. And I think that great teachers and great role models sometimes work on you immediately. You're immediately inspired. And sometimes they work on you gradually because the model that they offer is in contradiction to so many of the assumptions that you have. And obviously when that happens, there's friction. You may not like the friction. But if you reflect on that over time, you may discover that, in fact, the friction is actually what's really crucial. Mm-hmm. So for me, I've always valued friction. I've always valued the idea of challenge. Sometimes you need to challenge people at their deepest assumptions, and that means that you have to be okay with them being uncomfortable with you.
I know for me, when I was at Berkeley reading Edward Said as a freshman, just completely in Gene Ershick's class, he's a history professor, and if you remember him, and just completely changed my life. And I see a lot of Edward Said in you as well, too, like in your writings and just reading this nonfiction book. Because it's, you know, the way in which people always forget that Edward Said talks about two forms of Orientalism, both sort of the West when they orientalize, but also the ways in which we internalize. And it seems like that's also a conversation that you're also having as well, too, the ways in which we internalize these Orientalist narratives. Was Said a big influence on you?
Yeah, I read Said not as early as you did, but probably in my junior year, I think, and I used Orientalism to criticize in one of my senior theses, Graham Greene's The Quiet American.
Oh,
and so the framework that Said provided was there from a long time ago, as well as his general model of intellectual and political critique. And Orientalism, I realized even at the time, even though it was rather a challenging read for me as an undergraduate, I realized that it was also really a well-written book from my perspective, and that he was an engaged political activist. And I thought that this is a good role model for me to aspire to. So not just the intellectual arguments that he was making, but his general model of political commitment as well. And so I did want to, I've always referenced Said throughout my career, but I did want Nothing Ever Dies to aspire somewhat to what he was trying to do, which is to make a major intervention in the problem that he was facing and in the problem that I was facing, with the belief that, you know, you could take very complicated theory, he was working with Gramsci and Foucault, and yet apply it in such a way that would be relevant not just to academics, but to people outside of academia. And certainly Orientalism has had a life outside of academia as well.
So let's go back to food and to your book. So, you know, I love the sympathizer, and I'm sure you probably can anticipate this question. You posted this really funny quote on your Facebook, if you don't mind me reading. It's a rather critical review of this book. It's about a famous scene, which is, "I hate this book with a burning passion. It is impossible to follow and overly disgusting. In chapter 5, the main character, who does not have a name, has sex with a squid, then eats the squid. I read and take notes that this book makes no sense, SMH."
Yeah.
So that scene is awesome. I don't know if it is an homage to Philip Roth.
Absolutely.
It is an homage. Can you tell us a little bit? I mean, I think that quote's hilarious. I think it's even funnier that you posted it to your Facebook. You've got and there are several other quotes that you posted on that same.
I've saved a few of those.
Yeah.
You know, I read every review published of this book on Amazon.com and Goodreads. And the professional reviewers, like New York Times or whatever, they're not bothered by this because I think they all understand that it's literary and that's just an allusion to Philip Roth. But the non-professional readers are like, some of them are, you know, there's 1% of readers who just will not go past this episode, which I find very amusing, more than anything else. And I like to provoke those people. I like to think, oh, yeah, I got that person.
Is it white readers and Asian American readers, just all across the spectrum? Or
I can't tell. I think they're mostly all white readers, white women, too, as far as I can tell. But
fans of calamari, perhaps?
There was no plan to do that. You know, what I did do was, in writing The Sympathizer, I reread a bunch of books that had been important to me in some way beforehand to think maybe I can reference them or think about why they're influential on me or why I didn't like them initially. So Portnoy's Complaint, I wanted to reread because I'd read it when I was a little kid, 12 or 13 or something. The only thing that had stayed with me over decades was the scene where the narrator, Portnoy, masturbates with the family's slab of liver and then puts it back in the fridge for their consumption later that evening. I thought that was hilarious and disturbing back then, but I didn't remember anything else about the book. But I thought, I would like to try to write a comic book, so let me see if I can get something from this. And so I reread it. It was a much more more sophisticated novel than obviously I understood when I was a kid. And then, but I didn't think that I would put this the liver scene in my own novel. But as it happened, you know, I'd finished my writing for a certain day, stopped the scene that was going to be the meeting in the liquor store, the general's liquor store, and then I had to prepare dinner. And I'm the kind of writer, I'm the kind of person who needs to follow recipes. So I had a cookbook, but I'm going to challenge myself. I'm going to cook squid. So I had the squid already. And then I didn't know how to prepare squid. And so I read the cookbook and it said, oh, you got to clean the squid. And you do, the way you do that is by gutting the squid, taking the guts out with your fingers. So you have to put your fingers into the squid. So I put my fingers into the squid, two fingers, and gutted it. And I thought, wait a minute, this feels kind of familiar. And of course, all the whole scenario popped in my mind. And the next, and I thought, I got to write this scene.
Did you write it right then, or did you the next day?
I wrote it the next day. And I just incorporated it in there. And you know, and so sometimes writing doesn't happen by design. It happens by inspiration or accident or whatever. And I just went with it. And on the one hand, it was just totally gratuitous. And it was just a lot of fun to write. And I knew as I was writing it that this was perverse, but that it was also an homage to Philip Roth, and that I was having fun writing it, and hopefully people would have fun reading it. But there's a political point at the end, you know, which is that, you know, it says very explicitly, you know, maybe some people would find this scene obscene, masturbating with a squid. I don't find it obscene, my narrator says. You know, murder is obscene, massacre is obscene, 3 million people dead is obscene. Masturbation, even with an admittedly non-consensual squid, not so much. And, you know, the world would be a better place if we lived in, a world where the word murder made us mumble as much as the word masturbation. So it's all there in the scene, but the readers who don't like it sort of just freak out.
Which is so interesting, because like sometimes when I recall, I tell people the plot of The Sympathizer, if I were to include that as part of the summary, I could be like, it's about this war, it's about torture, it's about, I mean, among other things, about identity. And if I said, it's also about the squid scene, they'd be like, oh, that's too much, I won't pick it up. Which is insane. Like, hold on, the torture part didn't get you? It's the squid? I mean, this week when I was preparing for this episode, people kept saying, you got to ask him about that. The second sympathizer food-related question is about, there's a restaurant in the book. Yeah. Is it called Madam's or?
Actually, it's never given a name, but it's run by the general's wife, who's only known as Madam.
Oh, Madam. Okay, great. And there's a scene in there, and forgive me if I'm wrong, where, because I read that a while back, and then I read these two on the refugees in the nonfiction book this week, where they said, like, the narrator had wished the decor had looked nicer, I think, right?
Yeah.
And what's sort of interesting commentary. I mean, it's sort of, that's something that I think comes up again and again on our show, where a lot of chefs said, I grew up and Korean restaurants never look nice. I wanted to grow up and make a Korean restaurant where I didn't feel ashamed of it. Nice tables, clean bathrooms, no linoleum floors, no tube lights, etc. So what is that? What does that sort of scene like say to you?
Well, I mean, it speaks to how food is an index for economics and culture in probably every country, but here we're talking about the United States, so that the so-called ethnic restaurant is devalued in so many ways, from the labor that you can't see to the ingredients to the prices, and then to the general environment. So obviously, for Vietnamese people, the Vietnamese restaurant scene in the 1970s and 1980s was pretty bare bones. You know, you can't sell expensive food to refugees.
Yeah.
So there's already a cap there, which means that the restaurants are never going to be nice. They're never going to be elegant. And so I think that aspiration that you would want to have a restaurant that serves your food that is elegant means that you don't want to retreat from your culture. You know, you still want Vietnamese food, but you would like to have it be someplace you would want to take people who are not a part of your family or your culture. And the underlying issue there, obviously, is about value. You know, the better the physical environment of your restaurant, the more valuable it is, the more you can charge. And the more you can charge is an index of how valuable or successful your group is in American society.
Mm-hmm.
So the Vietnamese restaurateur Diep Tran already wrote this whole article about how, you know, we have an ethnic and racial hierarchy of food and value in this country that reflects racial hierarchies in general. So the idea is that you can't charge more than $5 or $8 for a bowl of pho, for example, but you can obviously charge a lot more for bouillabaisse.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can charge $25 for bouillabaisse. Now, why is that the case? It's because French people or French food is valued more than Vietnamese food, but this is a racist hierarchy that unfortunately Vietnamese people themselves also buy into.
Absolutely. My parents, they complain when Indian food is too expensive and, you know, we don't feel... do you ever have to apologize for calamari lovers when you're...
People, I never apologize, but I think people are always making jokes about the calamari and everything. I totally relish eating it myself.
Really?
Never have a problem.
Still no issue with your wife and you. So I know we just got a few more minutes. So, you know... It was really moving and actually difficult to read Nothing Ever Dies this week, just given the news about the U.S. dropping the mother of all bombs, as it's called, which is absurd. And I was just thinking that, you know, the Gulf War started when I was 13, and in many ways, we've sort of been at war throughout my adult life with the Middle East. We've been bombing the Middle East since then. And this book is such a hunt, all these books, but particularly I love the nonfiction book, but it's such a hunting memorial to that experience, to the war. And I'm wondering, how do we write about a war that doesn't sort of seem to have an end? I mean, it sort of seems like we're engaging in sort of constant warfare. And sort of, do you ever wonder, like, what the sort of war book will look like about the current war that we're in right now? Because given that many people even dispute the fact that we're at a war, whereas at least with Vietnam, it was a war. We can debate about the time frame, but, you know, there was a war. Whereas now, that term itself is debated.
Yeah, I think that we do have books about the wars that we currently fight, you know, and those books are typically about, you know, the experiences of American soldiers or the perspectives of American journalists writing about these extended wars and everything, but they still follow the conventional mode of the conventional war story, which is battles and foreign places and things like that. But I think what you're getting at is really important, which is that we are engaged in a war that has seemingly no boundaries over space or time. Mm-hmm. And that does, I think, require a new kind of book. And I think Maxine Kingston was trying to get at that with her book, The Fifth Book of Peace, you know, where, you know, her argument is that we really need to have a global understanding of both war and peace if we want to make any kind of a difference, or if we just even want to understand what war is. And I think that for so many people, including Americans, our understandings of war is really restricted to stuff on the battlefield. So if we're not actively bombing people, we're not really at war. Mm-hmm. Or even if we're actively bombing people, unless we have troops over there, we're not really at war. And so we need a new kind of war novel that actually talks about how, you know, war is sometimes the boring stuff that doesn't happen. You know, war is ongoing, it's a hum in the background, that's what I talk about, and Nothing Ever Dies. We need to have a war novel that is about those kinds of things. But that would entail also a radical shift in understanding in the American mindset as a whole about what war looks like.
Absolutely. You know, it seems like, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, one of the things I think that you did so beautifully is also in centering these stories around the Vietnamese experience. I mean, you spoke on, you know, in the past about how these books are not written for like a wide audience. Like on a practical level, sort of how does that live out? I mean, like, you know, I know you spent like 17 years writing The Refugees. Were there ways in which you sort of like held back some of your material to sort of say, well, wait a minute, it's not right because I'm not writing for the wide audience? Like that's a thing that chefs and writers sort of struggle with, you know, all the time, which is who is this for? I mean, has that been a struggle for you in writing? Like who's this for? And
when I was writing The Refugees over 17 years, I wrestled with the question of who it was for, you know, because I wanted it to be for Vietnamese people, but I wanted it to be for Americans in general as well, because I knew those were the people buying the books and publishing the books and everything. But I could not find a way to address that problem at the level of the writing of the stories, because I was mostly concerned with just, how do I write a story? Mm. You know, so if I had to throw on top of that the question of audience, it just was beyond my capacity to address. But after finishing those stories, I thought, I do have the capacity now, formally, to move on to the next challenge, which is to not write for white people explicitly. So The Sympathizer is a very different book in tone mm-hmm. and perspective, because I'd already worked out a lot of the technical issues of simply how to put a sentence together, for example. So I think that's not that different from being a cook. You know, when you're learning how to cook, you're just trying to master a recipe. Mm-hmm. And if your recipe, and you're trying to run a restaurant, and if you know your survival is dependent on white people, you got to address white people. Mm-hmm. And then you reach a certain level of confidence and stability. Maybe then you can do more experimental things. Or maybe you're confident enough to start from that position at the get-go, which I would really admire. Mm-hmm. So I think we're all struggling with that issue of the marketplace of our readership or our consumers or our customers, and of the aesthetic challenges in creation, whether it's food or whether it's literature. And we have to, I think, reach a certain level of political and technical competence and confidence before we are really able to do disruptive things, like throwing into doubt the very assumptions of the of the marketplace and the discipline that we're involved with, whether it's literature or whether it's food.
Yeah, well, the one thing I respect is that you are a writer that inhabits so many worlds, and we're so much better for all the conversations that you're leading, both sort of in through your novels, but also through your nonfiction. So I know, last question is, I know you're writing a sequel to The Sympathizer. Does the squid make a reappearance again? Is it true that they go off in Paris and they live...
You put a thought in my head. Oh, my God. Maybe I should just make it... You have a little signature scene across books. You know, maybe he has to have another sexual encounter with a baguette or something like that.
But are you really writing
I'm writing a sequel to Sympathizer. But baguette does really appear in the first 50 pages. You know?
A baguette so in a sexual way?
No, it's just a baguette. But is a baguette always a baguette? I guess now you just put some thoughts in my mind.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
This episode of Racist Sandwich is supported by People's Food Co-op and their 4,000-plus community members, offering responsibly sourced produce, groceries, and bulk items at fair prices since 1970. People's works with over 40 local farms and runs Portland's oldest farmers market every Wednesday from 2 to 7 p.m. Visit them at Southeast 21st Avenue, just south of Division Street in Portland, Oregon. Or visit peoples.coop. That's peoples.coop. You've been listening to the Racist Sandwich Podcast, the podcast on food, race, class, and gender. And this is Solejo. You can find more of our work on our website, racistsandwich.com. You can find us on social media, at Race and Food, on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, whatever. And you can also email us your comments, suggestions, complaints, do we blow your mind, anything, at racistsandwichpodcast@gmail.com. Our show is produced by Juan Ramirez. The music is by Aft the Naysayer and Blue Dot Sessions. Our logo is by Jen Tam. You can find more of her work at jentam.com. And please, if you have any inkling to do so, you can contribute to us, donate to our Patreon at patreon.com/racistsandwich. Any amount helps a lot and helps us continue the show and put out the quality content that, you know, all y'all enjoy, I would think. Thanks for listening.